Blog Talk Radio.
Take my love, take my land, take me where I cannot stand. I don't care, I'm still free. You can't take the sky from me. Take me out to the black. Tell them I ain't coming back. Burn the land and boil the sea. You can't take the sky from me. There's no place I can be since I found serenity. You can't take the sky from me.
Good evening. You are live with Tex and Rex, irreverent, relevant, and radioactive conservatism with a bite. I'm your host, Rex, broadcasting to you from the Ninth Circle of Hell, otherwise known as I-495, the Capitol Beltway around Washington, D.C.
And this is Tex, broadcasting not on Mordor time, but on normal American time. In Houston, Texas, from the Crystal Cathedral. So lots of things been happening in the news with the debate, and Romney had a foreign policy speech. So how'd you like to start, Rex?
Well, as always, we'll preface the beginning of the show to let everybody know the rules or lack thereof on the Tex and Rex show. We're just a couple of brown coats with a microphone. Not too many rules here, so by all means, if you care to challenge or interject, please call in 646-649-1013. Repeat, 646-649-1013. The only thing not allowed in our airwaves is blasphemy, so don't insult God and don't attack our guests. Feel free to attack Tex and Rex as much as you want. In fact, we welcome it. But do not attack our guests in chat or on the line. And we're going to take, as always, the first half hour of our show is, that's the relevant part. We'll give you some factual analysis information. And then after the first 30 minutes, we usually devolve into complete irreverence. So if you've got women or children listening, I suggest you lock them up for the middle segment. And then the last part will be radioactive. We'll give you some action items and things with that you can take the message of liberty out into the world and save your country, because if you don't do it, who the hell is? You brought up a lot of things, Tex. I think that, at least there's something in the news, but it all basically comes down to managed perceptions that the little hotties with the ever-shorter skirts on TV and the moron cheerleaders like Sean Hannity spew at you all day long to manage your mind. I just sometimes wonder if people even see the psychological trick that is being perpetrated on them with false choices. For example, this alleged foreign policy speech. If you want to tear into that, and then maybe we'll get some commentary from our guest this evening who happens to have a background in psychology who might lend us some interesting insights.
Yeah, sure. I want to talk a little bit about the debate, because I focused last time on Romney and how much he sucks and, his idiotic zingers. And, so as I went through this thing, I dug out a few things that Barack Obama said that just, kind of make your blood boil. So Obama is saying, in response to what is the question, this is where he says, we're still on the economy, we're going to come back to taxes. Okay, great. So President Obama gives a long, rambling answer. And then he says, the approach that Governor Romney is talking about is the same sales pitch that was made in 2001 and 2003, and we ended up with the slowest job growth in 50 years, right? We ended up moving from surplus to deficits, okay? And it all culminated in the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. First, that's actually false. It's not the tax cuts that caused the financial crisis, but anyway, the man's a complete moron. But Bill Clinton tried the approach that I was talking about, and we created 23 million new jobs. We went from deficit to surplus. No, Bill Clinton didn't. Newt Gingrich did that. That's why we should have been running Gingrich. That's all Gingrich's stuff. Drives me insane,
Wait,
man.
Are you suggesting that revenue bills originate in the House? Where'd you get that idea?
Wow, slanderous, I know. But actually, I was on line today, and someone was saying something about balancing the budget or something. And they said, well, if people really want a balanced budget, they would have voted for Al Gore in 2000 because they would have continued the Clinton policies. I mean, the level of cluelessness that you would have to type that sentence is beyond me. So that was one thing that that bothered me. Oh, yeah, and then he said, he talked about when Governor Romney stood on a stage with other Republican candidates, he was asked, would he take $10 of spending cuts for just $1 of revenue? And he said no. And now if you take such an unbalanced approach, this is so unbalanced, oh, my God, you know, then that means you are going to be gutting our investments in schools and education. You realize we have a $1.4 trillion deficit this year. We're spending $1.4 trillion on schools and education. Are you shitting me? What are these kids eating? Like plates of gold? Are their books made out of gold with diamond letters? I mean,
well, no, don't forget the parents still have to pay for the supplies. All that money that you're talking about is pretty much overbloated pensions for mediocre teachers who have been indoctrinating our children into the Marxist dialectic for near 40 years. And hence you have a diminishing product and an increasing cost because there is absolutely no free market in education. Tex, we've got a special guest. Yeah, we got a special guest on the line who's been not shutting up about government intervention for a long time. I'd like to bring him on and chat with him briefly before we tear into the psychology of this whole thing. So without further ado, let me introduce the man that started the Blog Talk Radio conservative movement focusing on Newt Gingrich, a brokered convention, and now the end of duopoly. It's Sammy Sanford. Sam, are you on the line with us?
Hey, Rex, and hey, Tex.
Hey, how's it going, Sammy?
Oh, I'm not feeling too well, but we're not going to shut up, and we've had some exciting news today. We got the Florida chairperson for the Constitution Party calling into the show on Sunday night. And Wednesday night, we got a sheriff running here in Florida. I've actually met the guy at a local Tea Party rally here. And his name, oh Lord, let me try to remember his name. I'm outside.
Why don't you tell us what, give the audience the name of the show, how they can find you on Blog Talk Radio, and give them the times of these interviews.
Constitution Unite. Constitutional
Conservatives.
Conservatives Unite. Tomorrow night we have the Constitution Party VP candidate coming on. Ashley, is at 10 o'clock tomorrow night?
10 p.m. Eastern time tomorrow night, and Tex and Rex will be taking the night off. So perfect. People can tune in for that. And then what time is it on Wednesday?
On Wednesday will be 8 o'clock, and Sunday night will be 8 o'clock. And tomorrow night, Rex, right here live on this show, will be a panelist on the show. We got Randy calling in to the show, too. Randy is the vice chair of the Constitution Party, and he is live on another show right now, but we are going to keep on speaking up and speaking out, whether my health tears me down or whether hell or high water comes. And the hell and high water right now are coming if we don't change our country. And we need real Constitution people out there like Gude. people. Plain and simple.
That's right, Sammy.
Well, Sammy, your voice has been the loudest, and we appreciate what you've done, and we're looking forward to hearing Mr. Clymer speaking tomorrow night on your show at 10 p.m.
Yep, and it's going to be awesome to have him on my show. It was awesome to have Virgil Good, which is good, on my show last Monday night. And I think you were there.
Yep.
And we had an awesome show. I mean, the guy stood on the show for about an hour and a half and took questions. Now, this weekend here in Florida, the Constitution Party has their state convention. I would love to be there, but you can't always do what you want to do. But we're standing up for constitutional values, and we're not shutting up.
Right on, Sammy.
Absolutely.
Right on.
Got to keep
well,
on
Sammy,
fighting.
What we're doing, we've got an industrial psychologist on the line that we're gonna bring in and kind of talk about the psychology of the debates and the candidates and maybe how some people are casting the vote. See what happens. So, did you want to plug anything else or throw anything else out there before we bring him on?
No, you can bring him on, and maybe I might want to comment after he speaks. He's probably an awesome patriot.
Okay. Well, you just stay on the line there, and we'll text. Did you want to introduce him, or you want me to just bring Mike on and have him introduce himself?
Well, let me finish my comments because it's
okay.
Transitioning into the debate. So
perfect.
So I was mentioning that they were doing this thing about the kids and how, you know, we're going to be gutting our investments in schools and education, $1.4 trillion. And so then later on, this is Obama, he says, and so if we take a balanced approach, what that then allows us to do, this balanced approach, is to help young people. Oh, great. The way we already have during my administration. You mean like with 20% unemployment? Because, you know, I felt screwed when I graduated high school, right? Because we ended up in a recession then, too. But nothing like today's kids. But they're being helped. Anyway, make sure that they can afford to go to college. And then he goes on to talk about the schools and all this kind of stuff. And some personal story about a lady that he talked to. And she said, they're using textbooks that are 10 years old. Oh, my God. Has algebra changed? You know? Has calculus changed since it was invented? You know, no, it's the same. You know, what textbook that's 10 years old, that's a history book, okay, yeah, but, I mean, when you were going to school, you remember, I went to school, history stopped at 1945 because they didn't talk about anything in the Cold War because it was considered a current event. Anyway, you know, there's some short story they need to read from the last 10 years. I mean, the whole textbook thing is a scam for all of those of you in college these days. They always try to get you to buy the latest edition, which costs $200. When you go to sell it back, it sells back for $5. And then you have to buy that next year's latest edition, which costs $200. And your professor, quote, wrote your book. Well, really, he co-authored it with somebody. He edited a sentence, and now he's getting a slice of your textbook, which is why you always have to buy the new one. But anyway, so all of this comes down to a question of, do the debates change people's perception of the candidates, or do they just solidify what they already think? So do people see what they want to see, or can they see changes? And if they can see changes, what brings about that change in their mind? So I've invited Mike from Chicago, who I assume Rex is buzzing in.
Hello,
right now.
Rex.
Hey, how's it going? Yeah, how's it going, Mike?
Good.
So Mike's an industrial psychologist, and he is going to talk to us a little bit about the psychology of the debates in terms of the viewer and their perception. So, Mike, I'll turn it over to you if you want to say a little bit about your background as way of introduction, and we'll get kind of down to things.
Sure. In terms of my background, I'm a PhD in industrial psychology from the Illinois Institute of Technology, and I've been very fascinated with the whole election process going up to this point, and including the first debate. And so I kind of want to throw a question back to you, Tex and Rex. Did your opinions change at all based on the debate?
I hate Obama, and Romney's still a douche, so no.
No, okay.
Yeah, I have to say that my opinion actually was significantly solidified, because what I saw was an orchestrated attempt to dupe me into thinking that there's a difference between the two guys. So it just kind of
exactly.
solidified me in the belief that they are identical.
Right. So there's a notion in psychology called confirmation bias.
Mm-hmm.
Which, and I think pretty much all of us would recognize this as being essentially a common human nature, but basically you want to confirm your beliefs, disconfirm things you do not believe in, and, you know, that sort of thing. So that's I think, definitely what's going on here, and what I see going on in this election is there's a very tiny, tiny, tiny sliver of undecided voters. Maybe like 5 or 10%. No, it's not even that large, but you know, it's probably 2 or 3%. And
would
so
you say confirmation bias is what led Snoop Dogg to write his 10 points?
Exactly. So, I mean, if there's like, again, if there are 2 or 3% of the population who are basically undecided, and the 98% are decided, there's nothing that's going to change that. Obama or Romney can do essentially whatever they want to in the debate, and it's not going to make a difference. I mean, the whole... whatever came out of the media during, you know, the last 2 days after the debates, or last few days after the debates, you know, the consensus was from both Democrats and Republicans was that the that Romney won, and Democrats still don't care, and Republicans still don't care. So it's really hard to change opinions at that point. You know, at the point.
This kind of leads into another issue, because what was surprising after the debate is you would assume that everyone would go out and they'd say, you know, Romney won on the Republican side, and the Democrats would come out and say Barack Obama won. But interestingly enough, with Mitt Romney down 13 points in some of the swing states and down 9 to 10 in a lot of them and basically losing badly, even the Democrats piled in to praise him. Bill Maher, you know, was
right.
going after Obama. James Carville said Mitt Romney took a chainsaw. You even had Van Jones. A committed communist. Under normal circumstances, there's no reason for a committed communist who's sensitive about it, but whatever. You know, now he's on to heavy socialism, not, you know, communism, I guess. But he's out there praising Romney, which makes me think that I'm a little suspicious. You know, that people are trying to make it look like there's more of a competition when really it's kind of a knockout.
Well, sure. I mean, I think that's more of a media bias, though, than anything else. I mean,
I forgot to ask my psychology question, which is if a person is sitting at home, right, and they are mm-hmm. sitting on the fence about one of the other two or going third party, as intelligent people are doing in this election cycle, to leave the two-party duopoly that screwed us over, how influenced are people by the fact that everyone is saying exactly the same thing and they want to agree with that, and sort of the bandwagoning effect?
In terms of like looking at people in terms of their political affiliation, they want to confirm what they would believe from their existing worldview or paradigm or whatever they're coming from. So I think it's really difficult to move them over from one side to the other. whether it's politics or religion or philosophy or some other kind of worldview.
Favorite beverage.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, it is. It's hard. It's a really difficult task. It can be done, obviously, but it's not really.
The Reagan Mondale debates, the media had gone out and wall to wall talked about how great Mondale did and how terrible Ronald Reagan did, the people who supported Reagan were still going to support. Because there's
pretty
not
much.
That much. Yeah, there's not that. There's not really enough there to
there's not enough
make
distance
you leave
between
your
the two. Yeah, exactly. I'm sorry, Rex. Yeah, go ahead.
That's all right. So, Mike, are you saying then that because the information is controlled and the choices are really non-choices, people will tend to just go with the comfort zone of their paradigm? So if they're right-leaning, moderate conservative, severe conservative, what have you, or just identify as Republicans, they're going to identify with Romney because he's on their team, irrespective of what might actually play out. So the question is, if people are going to be, you know, led by their confirmation bias due to their paradigm, does the introduction of legitimate new information that contradicts that, not in a rhetorical or a media propaganda manner, but true factual information that might challenge their paradigm about what they're seeing, is that likely to be able to shake them out of their confirmation bias?
That can shake them out of their confirmation bias if you found out that somebody led us into a foreign entanglement that was completely not justified and had really dramatic consequences or something similar to that on the domestic side. Yes, it could. Yeah, but it's rare that happens. And again, looking historically back at debates, really only
there was Ford with his "There is no communist occupation of Eastern
right,
Europe."
Right, exactly.
Kind of
yeah,
a what?
Thinking about that. So yeah. Exactly. There's no communist domination in Poland, was it?
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
He just gave a blanket Eastern Europe, but I'll have to go down.
Yeah, Eastern Europe. Yeah, right. So.
Well, reminds me of something
it could shake them out of their disconfirmation bias if there was something that dramatic, but it's rare that happens, and even people are very forgiving about. That sort of thing. So it's something that it really would have to be sort of a epiphany, you know, for them to change their political views or anything along those lines. So
yeah. So this reminds me when I was doing my degree in international relations, we had a course. That talked about, you know, various things. And one of the books we had to read was called Perception and Misperception in Foreign Policy. And the guy's last name, I forget, but it started with a J, you know, but I'll find it at some point.
Misperception is Hillary Clinton or Madeleine Albright? I don't know which one Misperception is.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. but what they talked about is that at the beginning of a crisis or at the beginning of any sort of problem, so this is sort of psychology for people who don't need to know too much about psychology. But what I recall is that people begin processing information early on in the conflict, and they're willing to accept all new data as something that needs to be evaluated. And so they're very good about evaluating all sources of incoming information. But then once they've processed that information or what they have at the time and they draw a conclusion, once they've drawn a conclusion, after
that's
that
right.
They have confirmation bias.
Yep. That's true. Those opinions harden and they become less, I guess, they're not going to be able to resist that at that point. So, yeah, you're right, Dan.
And is that what, Mike, gets somebody, for example, to see facts before their eyes that in and of themselves would contradict their ingrained biases and paradigm, but because it it is not fitting in with their confirmation bias given the particular decision that they're making, whether it's who to vote for or what have you, that they are willing to either overlook those facts or rationalize them and twist them to support their conclusion. For example, people who were actively supporting Michelle Bachmann, Herman Cain, Newt Gingrich, Ron Paul in the primaries, and then seeing Mitt Romney steal the nomination, but all of a sudden realizing that, well, their choice now is Romney and Obama, so they forgive Romney for all the terrible things that he's done and all the things they stood against for such a long period of time, to now say, well, I'm going to vote Republican.
Well, I think it's essentially a psychological compromise to do that. And, you know, it's an actual, you know, it's a political compromise, but it's also a psychological compromise where folks do tend to discount those things when it comes down to a important decision like voting. So I could definitely see that happening. But, yes, I would tend to agree with your premise of your
Well, this gets... I mean, Mike, you and I talked about this a while ago, but, you know, is it because people are playing game theory in the voting booth and like, well, if I vote for the guy I really want, he's not going to lose, he's not going to win, so I'm going to vote for the guy that doesn't really believe what I believe, but I'll do that to vote against this guy. You know, people are like wargaming this thing rather than expressing their opinion, or do you think it's like sort of a Stockholm syndrome where they're just prisoner of the two-party system and they feel they only have binary choices despite the fact there are other names on the ballot?
Well, I mean, it's kind of all the things could be going on, but, you know, one thing that is consistent is, you know, this notion of cognitive dissonance, which where people don't want to be dissonant with their own thoughts. So if I like a Republican... I don't care who the Republican is, but I can't, you know, I'm a good person. My values are correct. My worldview is correct. So I'm going to vote Republican versus, you know, a Democrat doing the same thing. And people love to have their views be consistent regardless of outside facts or anything like that. So that might be part of it, too.
And to the extent they can be convinced that they are consistent because they start focus grouping the message from the candidate to sound like what people want to hear, they're like, oh, okay, well, I could vote for this guy, even though we all know
Romney
he's a freaking rhino.
Romney sounds like, you know, he's fairly right-wing sounding, you know, comparatively to where he was back in Massachusetts or what have you. So,
well, I'm going to point out something very interesting in this foreign policy speech today, which we can get to in a bit. But this foreign policy speech was heavily focus groups. I mean, I sense the hoary hand of Frank Luntz all over this thing, where they're picking specific words. But one of the things that Romney said is this. Okay, so he's talking about the struggle in the Middle East to get rid of the dictators. It is a struggle of millions and millions of people, men and women, young and old, Muslims, Christians, non-believers, all of whom have had enough of the darkness. It is a struggle for dignity that comes with freedom and opportunity and the right to live under the laws of our own making. And then there's another bit, and we'll skip. And he says, in short, it is a struggle between liberty and tyranny. Oh, hat tip, Mark Levin. I mean, that's directly lifted from Mark Levin's book. So that directly... it's trying to appeal to the conservative base. And see, I'm saying the code words. Now, what I want to ask you is, you know, getting out of the psychology mindset, and as someone who watches politics closely as I do, don't you remember how in the primary you run to the base, and then in the general you run for the middle?
Argument.
What?
Yeah.
Have you ever seen a campaign where in the primary, you run for the center, and then in the general, you run for the base? I mean, I don't know. This smacks of desperation to me, but whatever.
Yeah. Well, here's an interesting thing, you know, regarding the use of code words that I'm kind of curious about. Now, obviously, most Americans, unfortunately, given the sad state of our education and mental capacity kind of don't pay attention to this stuff until, you know, late in the game, because it's just too overwhelming, and they sometimes think that they have no interest in politics, but politics always has an interest in them. But it sounds to me that you're telling me that the ingrained paradigms and that confirmation bias is so deep that most people are already locked into one vote or another in a binary system, in which case are all these hundreds of millions of dollars of campaign ads and campaign money and rallies and all that stuff, is that merely like McDonald's and Burger King simply advertising just to remind you that they're there because everybody already has their preference of Coke or Pepsi, McDonald's or Burger King? So you're really not going to win a new customer. You're just kind of creating a brand awareness for those who are already bought in. Is that kind of the same thing?
So, Rex, how many times have you heard the phrase bringing out the base, you know, during the campaign or during every campaign that you've...
Well, I think the Romney campaign is called Bringing Out the Dead, but yes, I have heard of Bringing Out the Dead.
Bring out your dead! like the plague. yeah, I mean, that's pretty much the whole strategy.
We're trifling with a small percentage of the voters when it comes to, you know, the Burger Choice versus the Burger King versus the McDonald's Choice. Yes, people can be changed. Their attitudes obviously change over their lifespan, but most of it is ingrained, and that's why it's mostly bringing people out to vote. So,
okay. Is it realistic to say that the extreme minority of actual thinkers, people who truly weigh their options and look at what they're choosing, are they the ones deciding the election, or is it pretty much already overwhelmingly to the kind of monolithic, predetermined confirmation bias block that's either on the right or the left or the blue or the red or whatever division you want to call it?
I think it's the latter, but that's just my opinion. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, Stex and Rex is an opinion show.
Yeah,
fire away.
You have opinion. As long as you
disagree with me, so.
Okay. Well, I'm fascinated by it because now tell me a little bit about how this tendency, this confirmation bias tendency, might bring about a massive psychological defensive mechanism when it's challenged by someone you would not expect to challenge you. Let me give you an example of what I mean. For example, you're a conservative who votes Republican, and you look at the plethora of candidates, you have your choice, and you pick one. Let's say you pick Newt Gingrich, and you're like, he's my man. And then he's, you know, either legally, illegally, or whatever, is just booted out of the choice, and you're left with a choice that you despise and you have despised for a long time. And you're well aware that the other side despises him too. So, you know, Democrats, liberals, Obama people, they despise him too. But all of a sudden, you're getting fellow conservatives who are supporting the same candidate as you before now telling you, hey, this guy that we thought sucked before, he still sucks. And what kind of psychological defense mechanism goes on there when your confirmation bias is challenged by those who you consider fellow travelers or compatriots?
Well, again, as I mentioned before, it causes cognitive dissonance, which can resolve itself in a number of ways. You could reject it, and you could vote for the guy that you thought that sucked, or you could just continue on that way. There's no way to predict that as a psychologist, to predict which way you'll decide. But those types of situations come up. I kind of like Rex's analogies of you know, choosing different burgers. You know, I mean, it's kind of the same thing, the same psychological process that comes up. You know, I had a bad burger here, I had a good burger here, I had a bad burger, or, you know, and somebody told me that, you know, no, it's not any good. And so what they would create, I guess, would be a cognitive dissonance, which would say that, you know, I like Newt Gingrich, and then you hear something that this confirms your belief in Newt Gingrich's sort of platform or his policies. And then but he's the only person.
Or the
who,
fact that you can't vote for him. You still agree with him, but he was eliminated as a choice.
Exactly, right. Exactly, yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a good point. So
you can't get that burger anymore. That place closed down.
Right.
So
I like Costco.
Well, I like Costco. I like Cole. I like Big Bird.
What is like trees?
Actually, no, he does not like Big Bird.
Oh yeah, he wants that.
He wants to off Big Bird. Yeah, that's a big policy decision there. I think we should decide the whole election on whether Mitt Romney likes or does not like Big Bird.
No, he actually says, I like PBS, I love Big Bird. He likes PBS, he absolutely loves Big Bird.
Oh, okay.
Interesting. He's gone beyond liking something to loving something. He loves Big Bird. So that's what he said. So I think Big Bird should get off welfare and start earning a living. Anyway, but something else I wanted to ask about is there's this strategy that's going on in this campaign. I'm sure you've seen it, Mike, and other people are noticing it as well, where Mitt Romney is trying to out nice guy Barack Obama. And I think where this is coming from is the Republicans can't believe they lost a guy with no resume, with no credentials, and he became the president of the United States against John McCain. Okay, so the reality of that election, at least in my opinion, this is setting the stage for the audience, not necessarily for you, but the reality of that election is that George Bush was historically unpopular. I think his strongly support was 19%, and strongly disapprove was mid-40s. So the Republicans are going to an election with that kind of liability, and, the leadership said, let's run a rhino, like either Mitt Romney or John McCain. That was the big choice back then, and so people went with John McCain because Mitt Romney sucks, and at least John McCain is a known quantity with a record of accomplishment behind him, whether or not you agree with it. So they went with the rhino, but the base didn't like John McCain, and so he brought Sarah Palin, and that excited the base. But the lesson they drew from that was Barack Obama won as an empty suit because he was a nice guy who spoke in generalities.
Right.
So they have recast Mitt Romney this time. This is why he never speaks in specifics. He's going to run as a nice guy who doesn't talk about his record because Barack Obama didn't need a record and speaks in generalities. But one thing I'm noticing here is the attempt to out-nice guy the other guy.
Right.
Now, this happened in the debate, but this also happened in this foreign policy speech today. So I just want to read you some things because it's more prevalent here. And he says, in Iraq, the costly gains made by our troops are being eroded by rising violence, a resurgent Al-Qaeda, weakening of democracy in Baghdad, blah, 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 all this kind of stuff. Okay, great. We already knew all that before you started talking, Mitt. And then he says, the president tried. He tried, but he also failed to secure a responsible and gradual drawdown that would have secured our gains. He says, later on, the president is fond of saying that the tide of war is receding, and I want to believe him as much as anybody, but look at the Middle East today. And then he goes on shortly thereafter to say, I know the president hopes for a safer, freer, and more prosperous Middle East allied with the United States. I share his hope, but hope is not a strategy. Then he concludes, that's another point. Okay, but hope is not a strategy. So what I'm wondering is, in this attempt to, kill him with the kindest cut of all, does that convince people in the other party, or would you see someone being convinced like, this guy is luring me away with a bowl of warm milk?
Yeah, it can definitely go both ways, but I would say, if there are a lot of, foreign policy, domestic policy crises going on, or not even crises, but even issues that are going on, it's not going to work. That sort of thing does not typically work. That's my sort of reading of what the polls are, and also what my reading of just general psychology. But those rational appeals are not going to be as great as say an emotional appeal, where let's say George W. Bush would say, you know, we've got to stop the terrorists or something like that. So I think that approach would probably be better in that type of situation.
That type of approach would be better in what type of situation?
So in a crisis situation, the George W. Bush approach would work much better, which I think, you know, has happened in the past, and that's what happened during, me being partisan or whatever, you know, FDR made the same appeal economically during the during his election. So, I mean, I think that's pretty much the same thing. So
in desperate times, they may run for that. They may go for that sort of warm bowl of milk thing. And I think, you know, Rick, to get back to your point with the people who are Newt supporters who absolutely hated Mitt Romney and, you know, understood that basically the guy is a liberal Democrat, wolf in sheep's clothing. I've seen that symbol somewhere. running in our party. When he eventually finally won, they just sort of decided that, well, you know, I'm going to have to go along with Mitt Romney because there's such a crisis, so I've been lured away because I don't know what else to do except to give my vote over to someone who basically has the exact same policy.
Yep.
That's pretty much what I'm reading out of it.
Yeah. It's fascinating to me that people will go through these machinations to justify their vote. Let me take a different angle then. Given that in these United States we kind of take voting for granted, that, you know, it's our government, it's for the people, of the people, by the people, blah, 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 all the stuff that you hear, which at some point in our past may have been true, but doesn't seem to be the case anymore.
Right.
And we hold this power to vote as, you know, hey, this is my way of participating, and, you know, I'll go vote, and I'll vote for, you know, what is the best choice at the moment to, you know, to stop this bad agenda. But, you know, after that, you know, I've done my part, and I'm just going to go about my business. So have we grown apathetic about our vote? Do we not realize that it's a very powerful expression of who we are and what we want? And are we also jaded to the fact that our vote really makes a difference? Is that possibly why people are willing to compromise on their vote, because it's not held so dear as it would be for people who've never had a chance to vote?
Well, I think people are told every day that their vote doesn't make a difference, because how many swing states are there right now?
Seven or eight.
So if you don't live in those seven or eight states, your vote pretty much is gone.
So go third party if you're in one of those states, right? Let the party hear what you really feel, right? Might as well. And then the party can say, hey, what's with, you know, the third parties? All of a sudden they got this massive uptick in votes, you know. We need to get back to the base, right? We need to start going back to where, you know, the conservatives are. Now, you know, you may not want to go back to the conservatives, but, you know, whatever. But the idea is to increase the third party vote to send a signal to the two-party duopoly, either that the jig is up and your facade is coming crashing down, or to give them a chance to redirect their efforts into going back and seeking our votes instead of treating us like a bunch of people that can, you know, at the end of the day, you'll just vote for the elephant no matter who we put up there.
I mean, you know, if they brought back zombie Hitler and ran him as a Republican, would these Republicans vote for him? I wonder sometimes.
Zombie Hitler supports brains.
Yeah. Well, in that case, he can't possibly want these current Republicans. They're missing brain. Listen, folks, we're 45 minutes into this. We got an hour and 15 minutes of show left. The call-in number is 646-649-1013. Repeat, 646-649-1013. We are talking about the psychology of your vote and the psychology that the candidates are employing and their campaigns are employing to woo your vote, if they even care about it. So if you want to call in and chat about
who you're voting for, why you're voting for them, and how you've made the calculus to make that decision, please do. And if you just want to call and tell us that we're full of hot air, please do. We'd love to be challenged. So again, 646-649-1013. I'm going to bring Sammy Sanford on live and see if he has anything to chime in about with you, Mike. I muted him because there was some background noise. Sammy, are you there?
I'm here.
All right. Did you want to throw anything towards Mike and see if he's got any interesting responses and insights?
Mike. Hey, Mike. How you doing from the great state of Illinois?
Oh, great. Yeah. I'm doing fine right now, so.
And that's awesome. And really, I've been listening to you, and you are speaking the truth. I was a Newt supporter from the get-go, and we got sidetracked by the RNC, and right now we are supporting third parties, at least I am, and we will not shut up and back down, plain and simple.
I think that's a good thing. I wish our political system supported third parties as well, unfortunately. So I'm not sure what position you're in, but, I've ended up myself voting for either Ron Paul as a write-in candidate or Libertarian Party candidate.
Awesome.
So, yeah.
And I have no issue whatsoever now with that. After what the RNC did to us in Tampa, Ron Paul. Go Ron Paul.
Well, one interesting thing about Mike, and Mike, if you don't mind if I kind of talk about this, because Rex and I have been accused of being Ron Paul bots, right? You know, when, I mean, you know me. We were in college back in the 90s when I was rabid Newt Gingrich. I was fighting with all of them. If you weren't talking good things about Newt Gingrich, man, I mean, who knew what was going to happen in that apartment?
Hey, Tex, you've also been accused of Rex and Tex tying me down, turning me into a Paul bot.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, we've turned Sammy into a Paul bot now, too. But, Mike, you, back then, you certainly were not a Ron Paul aficionado. You were very much in the Democrat camp. And so I find it kind of interesting that you and I have both ended up in the same
in college. But, Democrat.
Isn't everybody a communist in college?
Well, folks, I'm going to let y'all go, and you're awesome, and I like your message, and tomorrow night I have the Constitution Party vice president on my show, and I hope Rex and Tex don't mind me advertising this.
No, we insist that you do. Why do you think we're broadcasting
Absolutely.
At 10 o'clock?
He's going to be on my show tomorrow night, and thank you, Rex, very dearly for what you did tonight, and will leave that off the air.
Yeah, Sammy, that's all right.
And
the important thing is that you're going to be interviewing Jim Clymer tomorrow at 10 o'clock Eastern on Constitutional Conservatives Unite, and Tex and Rex are taking the night off, so please, everybody, tune in tomorrow at 10, Constitutional Conservatives Unite. And Sammy will be talking to vice presidential candidate for the Constitution Party, Jim Clymer.
Yep, he is awesome. Then we got somebody running for the Sheriff's Department here in Florida on Wednesday. Then on Sunday, we have the chairman of the Constitution Party of Florida on the show. His name is Mark, and we're going to have an awesome show, but you are awesome for what you were saying. I agree with you 100%. I have been with the Tea Party movement, and I've seen the Tea Party movement cave. We cannot do that no more. We have to hold our values. And if we lose...
compromising with evil.
Exactly. And if we lose our values of constitutional conservatism, we are screwed. And I forgot, what was your... Tim?
Mike.
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 Mike, I'm sorry. And you can hit me with a baseball bat. but you are awesome. And
thank you,
Rex and Tex, for having an awesome patriot on the show. And
thanks for popping in, Sammy.
Thanks for dialing in and anytime. And you're always welcome to promote your show on our show.
Love y'all, brothers. Bye-bye.
All right, Sammy. Have a good night. We'll see you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow night. Bye-bye.
All right. I wanted to explore that a little further, what you were talking about there, Mike and Tex. So back to you guys.
Yeah, so if I could just, re-tee up the question, I guess. It's that you and I have sort of, Mike, you and I have ended up kind of in the same place, sort of politically or damn near. And, but we started from completely different places, and we used to fight vociferously, but you were always the most informed of the opponents. And, of course, you knew I was the guy who had, like, 19 people yelling at him in the room all the time. So, I was holding up the shield, jabbing where I could, But anyway, so maybe you could talk a little bit about how you – well, I mean, how did you end up Ron Paul? What was kind of the intellectual process there?
Well, I guess I started off as a Marxist in college and then moved to a sort of moderate Democrat, during the Clinton administration. And just thinking about all the domestic policy issues and the foreign policy issues in particular, I actually supported the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, and now I look back on that and I think, I think I was wrong on at least one of those things. And,
hey, at least you just kind of mentally supported it. I worked in Washington during that. So.
Oh yeah, exactly. Right. So it was kind of a transformation. It's just going from left to right. And, Churchill has a famous quote about that where I think he says, if you're not young and liberal, you don't have a heart. And if you're not, older and a conservative, you don't have a brain. So,
right.
So this kind of that sort of movement going in my direction. So,
Well, guys, I find it very interesting that you kind of approached it from two different angles, coming from a materialist Marxist view and a traditional conservative Republican view. And then as you both move, we have to remember that the whole game is moving, and you both kind of centered on the liberty candidate, Ron Paul. And I think that Ron Paul's message was very clear. It was that liberty unites. And I think it shows a clear example here where you can approach it from two different angles and end up on liberty. And I think it's because, and Tex and I have talked about this before, it's this managed perception that there is a left-right paradigm, when in fact it doesn't exist. It's about total control and total power, total freedom. And so I think that Ron Paul kind of gave everybody, no matter what sense of the left-right spectrum they came from, a different option, and that is liberty. And I'd like you to talk about this, Mike, from the perspective that you look at the overwhelming majority of the Ron Paul revolution within the Republican Party. They tend to be young, under 30 years of age, looking for liberty and freedom, and many of them are, believing Christians. Many of them are atheists or agnostics or deists. So it wasn't really a religious fervor as much as it was this idea of liberty. And then on the other side, you've got this Occupy Wall Street movement that seems to identify a lot of the same problems as the Ron Paul revolution, but then they kind of have a departure in solutions, whereby the Ron Paul revolution solutions are steeped in Austrian economics and free markets. The Occupy Wall Street tend to go to the Marxist dialectic with state socialism. So how does that kind of identifying the same problem yet coming to different conclusions, how does that play out psychologically?
Well, I think it comes down to education, because you don't really know about Austrian economics, even if you're,
didn't they teach that in eighth grade? Political science?
Yeah.
Social studies?
Exactly.
Austrian economics?
This whole issue of Keynesian economics versus Austrian economics, you know, I was never taught Austrian economics. I don't know if you were, Dan, or Tex.
It's okay. I sort of go by both names, kind of preferring Tex lately, but you can get away with it only because I know you.
Right. So economics is Keynesian economics, essentially. When you're taught it in school. So, you know, I think that's, you know, one of the things is, you know, you have to rebel against that if you're going to come to that viewpoint and actually look at the, you know, what they're saying about the, you know, monetary policy or what have you. I mean, I don't think there's really, there's not really like two choices are given to you in your
secondary. Yeah, it's just sort of accepted
education.
This is the guy who was right. And so nobody else mattered.
Exactly, yeah. Right.
Well, and let me interject here just briefly, because I don't want our audience or those listening in archives to get a little confused. Keynesianism, which is probably what you think of as the entire gamut of economics, is exactly what Mike and Tex just said, taught in school. And it is the belief that government monetary intervention and, quote, stimulus or inflation can solve the boom-bust cycles in a market economy.
Steering the market is the buzzword. They think they can steer the market.
Steer the market.
They hit a tree, but whatever.
Yeah. It's a command economy, and it was espoused by Lord Maynard Keynes, who was a Fabian socialist. Whose, incidentally, their logo is the wolf in sheep's clothing, so that tells you a little bit about their mentality. And it was the dominant economic system promoted by the Marxists.
FDR.
And FDR and Woodrow Wilson, which, incidentally, actually, it arrived in these United States before it was introduced by the communists in Russia. And long before it was introduced by the Nazis in Germany. And the interesting thing is that we're taught that there's this left-right difference within the Keynesian paradigm. And what the Austrian school, just so that everybody doesn't get confused, it really has nothing to do with the country of Austria. It just happens to be where the school that these early economists who you know, looked at this theory were teaching, so it became called the Austrian school. But just think of it as a different school of thought, not a geographic location. The Austrians said that markets can't be commanded and controlled because it is impossible to do economic calculation from the top down when you have millions of actors making millions of decisions, and that the markets themselves are efficient based on those individual choices. And that in a system that is using the Austrian method of free markets with a stable and sound currency, you won't have a boom-bust cycle. You will simply have creative destruction as new industries replace old industries, but there won't be a boom and a bust because the new industries will actually create more employment, more wealth, and more benefit to more people, as opposed to the Keynesian system, which actually withdraws wealth and withdraws choice. And then you end up with more stimulus, which furthers the cycle along. So
and
I just wanted to interject that.
I would just give a plug out to a YouTube video. It's about 5 minutes long. It's kind of funny. It's done in like a rap battle type form called Keynes versus Hayek. I think there's three parts of this thing now, but the first part is really good. And if you watch it and kind of pay attention to it, at first you'll be distracted because the song sounds crappy the first time, and the second time you kind of like it. But then if you're paying attention to what the words are, you can start to understand the difference in what the two basic philosophies are. So I would recommend that, you know, as kind of a quick introduction to when you get a chance.
Well, let's take it back to your conversation.
I guess I should take
it back to your conversation. Yeah, no, take it back to your conversation. I just wanted to make sure that everybody was following along with the terminology of Keynesianism.
Yeah. Well, I was going
to
say, the first time I heard of anything even hinting of Austrian economics, and of course I didn't know it was Austrian economics, was Pat Buchanan mentioned that he was talking with Michael Kinsley on Crossfire or something, and they were talking about, I don't know, maybe it was the savings and loan crisis at the time or some financial crisis. And, you know, Pat Buchanan made some snide comments saying, well, it makes you start to think that maybe these gold bugs are onto something, right? So gold bugs. What was a gold bug? So I had to go look up gold bugs. And I found out
gold
these people
standard.
Who believe in the gold standard and all this kind of stuff. And I thought, how medieval. Yeah, I'm going to run around with my Spanish doubloons, you know. But that was my first exposure to it. Now, interestingly enough, Pat Buchanan was an advisor in the Nixon administration. Nixon was the one who took us off the gold standard in 1971.
Right,
so,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, so maybe there's an old axe to grind there. But that was the first I kind of heard about it.
Well, interestingly enough, first of all, I put both of the Keynes versus Hayek rap videos in chat for anybody who is looking at it, and they are actually hilarious and quite poignant. And then second of all, I would be wary of saying Nixon did it. And here's the problem. See, we have this false perception the president does these things, but since 1913, monetary policy has had absolutely nothing to do with the executive branch or the legislative branch where actually it belongs. The Constitution specifically puts the monetary power in Congress to coin and set the value of domestic and foreign coin and weights and measures in the same enumerated power, weights and measures, because it's important that money is a unit of measure. It measures the transactions. It is not in and of itself necessarily a commodity, although gold is a commodity, but when it's used as money, it has a different purpose. That power now belongs squarely in the few banks that own the New York branch of the Federal Reserve, and those policies are put forward by the globalist bankers. And it doesn't even really need the president to sign off on it because it's pretty much like, hey, jerk off, we're doing this, so you might as well look like you know what you're talking about and agree to it because we're doing it anyway. So I wouldn't necessarily put the blame on Nixon. And if I was to put the blame in anyone in the executive administration at the time, I'd probably lay it squarely on the shoulders of Henry Kissinger as opposed to Richard Nixon.
Well, I blame the French. Weren't they? That was their deal. They were going to go cash in all our dollars for the gold, and they're like, screw you.
Yeah. It's always good to blame the French.
You just got a lot of questions there. Rex, why Kissinger on that?
Why Kissinger? Kissinger is clearly heavily embedded in the what has come to be called the New World Order, which is basically the transnational bankers who have absolutely no allegiance to any particular nation. It's all about profit and control. And he was basically their tool to kind of manage the president. Usually what happens, unless the president
interject real quick, Rex, because we were talking about confirmation bias and outside information. Okay, so, you know, when I first started getting involved with this and people started talking about the New World Order, I was like, kooks. because, you know, I was in foreign policy, so here's what the, quote, New World Order is. Originally, the New World Order was a speech that George Bush gave that said that once communism was over in the Soviet Union, so he gave the speech long about 89, 90, I think he gave it 90, early 90, but I can't be sure. Anyway, he said that there would be a New World Order because of the end of communism, because what had happened with the creation of the UN was that the Soviets always exercised a veto over everything the UN did. And one of the few times it didn't was for the Korean War when the Soviets actually happened to be out. So they were able to get that thing through. Okay, so what they said they were going to do is we would all work together, you know, the victors of World War II would work together to create a new world order, a world without war and all this, you know, there'd be rainbows and all this kind of stuff. Right, so that was the original New World Order, and the first Gulf War was sort of a product of this because Saudi Arabia didn't like the fact Kuwait was there and all this kind of stuff. And so everybody came together and we defeated Saddam Hussein, right? But we noticed we did not invade Baghdad, which we easily could have done, but we didn't because Iraq was a Russian ally and we didn't want to cause a larger regional war, and that's why we never did that. So that was the original New World Order. Now, that phrase was taken by several people, one of which is actually Pat Buchanan, who, when he was running in 1996, he started talking a lot about the New World Order, right? So about 6 years after the original speech, when, you know, the Soviet Union was kind of on its back, I guess, at that point, because the price of oil was way down and, you know, their economy, they were going through shock therapy at the time, it morphed into more talking about the international banking industry and things like the Federal Reserve and the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. So what the New World Order has come to mean is not, you know, what I was taught in foreign policy class, but rather is now more about international banking, printing money, and a group of people essentially collaborating to enrich themselves at the expense of the rest of the world.
Yep.
So that's a quick crib sheet for those playing at home or, you know, for whatever issue. You didn't know, but we're not doing chemtrails, you know, and the blue helmets aren't coming in and all that kind of nonsense.
Yeah, this, on this show we only go so far down the rabbit hole because of the fact that it's only a two-hour show. But I think, Mike, you were making a point regarding New World
Order. That chemtrail stuff is insane, man. That's just insane. I'm just putting that's a marker. You're nuts. But anyway, go ahead.
Hey, maybe a year ago you would have said FEMA camps are insane, but they're legit.
Well, no, I wouldn't really add to what Dan said, except for, you know, it started to spark a thought in my brain about, you know, the speech that Eisenhower gave when he, you know, he was going out of office or whatever about, you know, beware them. Military industrial complex. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it just made me wonder. You know, what do these guys know, and what are they willing to tell? But anyway, that was just a thought.
Well, not worry about those guys. You kind of got to worry about anybody who's in a position of power. I've come to realize as I've gotten older, because who goes after these positions? Usually, like
arrogant.
A maniac. Right?
Arrogant, ambitious megalomaniacs.
Yes. Sociopaths. That's why the Founding Fathers, that's why they created the Electoral College system, was so that people could express their opinion as to who they thought would be best, but they believed that candidates shouldn't campaign for office. The office should find the man. Now, in a perfect world, the office would find the man. Unfortunately, we live here on planet Earth, otherwise known as hell, and, you know, get the guys campaign. Well, who's out there campaigning? You know, basically people who are kind of full of ego and, you know, maniacal in a lot of ways. And, you know, that's not to say all of them are necessarily bad or anything, but they certainly, you know, they're not cut from the same cloth as everyone else. And so sometimes you get a few nutbags. And any position of power can be kind of converted into God only knows what. You just watch history and they do it all the time. So in addition to the military-industrial complex, you got to watch out for who's controlling your currency. Even the Founding Fathers were on about this. They're like, you know, the ability to print money. I mean, I don't know. I mean, can we, you know, so. And we got the Federal Reserve. Remember all that stuff about the Bank of America? And now we have a Federal Reserve. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. The interesting thing, Tex, is that a lot of, and what Mike just pointed out, that warning speech, that Eisenhower farewell speech talking about the military-industrial complex, is obviously these guys get privy to certain things that the rest of us don't see, or maybe we just simply conjecture in conspiracy theory. But they often can't say anything about it until they're no longer an issue, like their final speech. And, in fact, Woodrow Wilson, who was basically railroaded into signing the Federal Reserve Act, regretted his decision. Abraham Lincoln, who, you know, spoke out against the money power, was shot. John F. Kennedy, who actually had the Treasury issue silver certificates, which were U.S. Treasury notes backed by silver in the Treasury. He was shot. Reagan actually at one point said, you know, well, why do we even have this Federal Reserve thing? And that was before March when he was shot. So it often is that, and it has been said that there are very rich and powerful industrialists in this country who fear something far bigger than they, and they won't even talk about it. So out there.
Well, some of them are just jerks, though.
That 100%, were you aware that 100% of people with six-pack abs die?
Yeah. The same with 100% of non-smokers.
Yeah.
So the interesting thing is to keep in mind is that sometimes we'll hear about these things from them when they feel comfortable doing it, and other times we'll get resounding warnings in advance. For example, we got massive warnings about this from George Washington, from Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson, who took on the Second Bank of the United States and actually defeated it prior to the resurgence of the Federal Reserve. So what people have to understand is that as long as the control of the currency, which is basically the calculus of the entire economy, is in the hands of a monopoly cabal, then the political winds are always going to be corrupted by this power. And this goes back, thousands of years, because even in the Bible you will read, the love of money is the root of all evil.
Uh-huh.
And so when we talk about the wars, and we talk about the distribution of wealth, and we talk about our foreign policy, and we talk about the welfare program, we talk about surveillance and drones and all this stuff, that's kind of beating at the branches, because the root of it is that they have an unlimited supply of money with which to do these things, and if you simply took that away, we would have a far greater return to, you know, sound policies, because they simply couldn't afford all the things that they're doing now with impunity. And the interesting thing is we're talking so much about the presidential election, which the Founding Fathers never envisioned us really doing, because the president's power is actually quite limited, except in times of war. And, of course, times of war can only really be legally enacted by Congress. So the presidential power is rather limited, but we've had such an incredible consolidation of power in the executive that it has become the most powerful and therefore potentially the most dangerous position on the planet, which is why it has become important. And, gentlemen, we've got 47 minutes of show left, and we are joined by two guests who were probably just in the mosh pit of Bard's Logic Political Talk. We've got Chris from the Coalition of Freedom on Facebook, and we've got Randy, who has a blog talk radio show, Constitutionally Correct, and he is also the vice chair of the Constitution Party. Chris, Randy, you guys are live.
Good evening.
Good evening,
hey,
gentlemen.
How's it going, Randy?
And I hear that loudly.
What's up?
The mosh pit, huh?
That's right.
Hey, I tell you, some pretty fantastic material, though. Poor Chris didn't get a lot of the questions answered that he was wanting to get answered that he posed to me in his document, though.
There's always some.
We have run away far.
We'll get around to it.
Don't give any ideas.
I figure I'm going to be. I think I'm kind of like that bad penny that keeps coming back. I think you guys are stuck with me now.
The question is, are we stuck with you, or have you gotten stuck with us?
Yeah. What have you gotten yourself into?
Especially on the Tex and Rex show, because our format is definitely chaos. Chris and Randy, and for all you new listeners who joined us in the second hour, we are talking to Mike, whose background is in industrial psychology, and we've been kind of addressing the psychology of the debates and how people view them and confirmation bias and such. So we've been having a real good discussion about how the entrenched duopoly maintains itself by employing psychological trickery in order to get us to be so entrenched in our worldview that we can't see things differently. Hence, people get labeled, especially Rex here, with the tinfoil hat conspiracy theory label, because the truth is far too powerful to be let out.
I have a question for Mike.
Yes.
Okay. How much of today's psychology and marketing is spun off the MTV generation explosion?
I didn't catch all of that question.
You know, you look at the whole MTV generation and how we changed what a hero was, you know, what was important, what success was, and the winners and losers of society. And, you know, I mean, I grew up, you know, I was an adult by then, but I saw that generation come on. And I also watched the way they run the primary and the way they feed information to people and the way they play, you know, the game show mentality on our candidates and the way they shove them down our throats. It just seems to me that there's a similarity there. You know, I just wanted your input on that.
No, I completely agree with that. And, you know, some of the people in my field, industrial psychologists, but just general psychologists, behaviorists, and so forth, like John Watson and John Watson in particular went into advertising as a career. So, I think there's definitely a role there that's been played where people have sort of, I guess, used, you know, psychological principles that are very basic, like operant conditioning, classical conditioning, and things like that, in advertising, and then that's been, gone into political advertising as well. So,
hey, could I ask a question?
Yep.
You know, this goes to the actual debate, and maybe the question's been asked because we're just kind of showing up late here. But, you know, my question is this. Romney, on more than one occasion, slipped up and said North America as opposed to just saying America. Is there really a psychology that's going on there? Was that just a slip? Or was he sending a message to people? What's your take on that?
I can't speak to like an individual act of behavior like that, but there is in my experience there is something to the notion of a Freudian slip like that. It does mean something to me. It does, and that's just based on my experience. But yeah.
Mike, someone says, let me tell you about my Muslim faith. I mean, my Christian faith.
Yeah, Mike, as a follow-up, let me ask this then. Is it just as likely it's a Freudian slip, meaning that he knows something and he's trying to convey something else, as it is that he's maybe prepping the audience for the upcoming policy changes that might include North American policies as opposed to American policies?
Oh, you know, I wouldn't read that much into it, but that's my opinion. I would, just read it as a slip up. And, you know, some synapses get crossed somewhere along the line. It could be that, you know, you could be right, but I can't really, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
say,
it's like,
you know,
perhaps I give
a
him,
mind reader.
Yeah, perhaps I give him too much credit for having the intelligence to prep the audience. It just could be
exactly.
Mexican inbreeding that caused the synapses to.
Well, if you guys wanted like a little topic to launch us off, since we're all here together now, maybe I could turn back to this foreign policy speech. I took a few notes, and I can share a few things that he said that I thought was kind of strange. So he's talking about balancing the budget and all this kind of stuff, and he's going to raise taxes he's not going to raise taxes or whatever, he's going to lower taxes for the middle class and all this kind of stuff, this, that, and the other, right? And then he goes on to say that, which I thought was interesting, the size of our Navy is at levels not seen since 1916. I will restore our Navy to the size needed to fulfill our missions by building 15 ships per year, including 3 submarines. Okay, so I'm assuming the 3 submarines is a shout-out to the people down in Alabama where they build submarines and all that kind of stuff, and I think they build them up in Baltimore, too. But I'm just wondering, like, is it really the number of ships? I mean, in 1916, what was the firepower of a ship? Didn't they just have, like, those, you know, what were there, four turrets on the thing, and everything else was just like a stupid machine gun to keep airplanes away, but you had like four turrets with six guns. I mean, what was the firepower of that thing? Not much.
Well,
and now there's like missile ships. I mean, do we really need the same number?
Well, you have a
You're talking about 60 years after the ironclads were first developed in 1916. Mm-hmm. So I think that the exponential growth in technology and firepower is astounding.
Ask the Marine there.
Yeah. I think Romney should go on about our strategic coal reserve. Anyway, go ahead.
But, Chris, you got to understand, I am a Marine, and the only thing that the Navy was useful to me for was it being a taxi service.
Yeah, but you were on those ships. I'm sure you saw the firepower.
Marines always ride naval equipment.
You know, there's several misnomers in that. You know, the fact of the matter is that we have more technology, more firepower, more than anything we could imagine. I mean, we can destroy this globe how many times over with all the firepower that we have nowadays. So, you know, that's really just a bunch of garbage and just a bunch of crap for rhetoric, because, quite frankly, all we need to do is bring our Navy back to the shores of these United States, bring our Marines, Air Force, and Army back to the land of these United States. And I'm telling you, nothing. I don't care what they say. You know, we got to keep the terrorists out there, you know. Bring them home. We'll keep them out there. They will not penetrate our defenses.
Well, Randy, can you permit me subversive for just a second? When he adds at the very end, 15 ships per year, including three submarines. Now, that tells me a little something. It sounds like a shovel-ready job he's come up with. You remember how Obama had shovel-ready jobs? There's no difference between these two parties. It's the same freaking thing. People, they're getting fooled, and they're voting for this crap.
So you're saying one builds bridges and one builds things that break up bridges in other countries, but both of them are basically shovel-ready jobs.
I don't know. Yeah, let me throw this in. I just interviewed one of the Constitutional Party, I think it was U.S. Senator for Mississippi. Oh, they are building ships down there. You know, he was a lifer. He was a lifer Navy guy. 30 years he's worked in the defense, you know, the private defense industry, and we had him on for, I don't know, an hour the other night. So Romney's lying. They are building ships. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm going to skip the Iranian sanctions thing because that's a little wonkish, but that just raised my hackles because it's such nonsense. But he goes on to say, and in Afghanistan, I will pursue a real and successful transition to Afghan security forces by the end of 2014. I will pursue a real and successful transition to Afghan security forces. That's the Vietnamization of the war, right?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, we already did this. So look forward to, in 3 years, a dude on helicopters running off the roof of the embassy or whatever. Just either go there and do something or get the hell out.
Well,
don't,
you know, look.
Afghanistize the war.
Anyway. You want to have a successful transition to the Afghan forces? Pack your bags and get the Sam Hill out of there, and believe me, they'll start picking up the forces.
Well, my policy, I've called it fuck 'em. And basically, that's where you just pack up your shit and you fly out. Fuck 'em. Like, Obama's dead, Osama is dead, right? Al-Qaeda's not really there anymore. And it's a backwards part of the world. Who cares? You can't build a nation there. There's never been a nation there.
Well,
hey, this is respect.
Well, Tex.
You know, no, Tex. It doesn't work.
But here,
Tex, hold on a second, Randy. I got to bring in another caller. But,
okay.
But real quick, I think that, Tex, what you're suggesting, as you said it, fuck 'em policy, is the ancient war policy that has been employed by the victors all throughout history. And it goes a little something like this.
Conan, what is best in life? Crush your enemies, see them driven before you, and to hear the lamentation of your women.
That is good. That is good.
Now that's a foreign policy, and we just got Robert Jetter of Bard's Logic Political Talk on. So
Robert, you are now joining the fray, and I think Randy had a point to make, so let's go Robert and then Randy.
With the, excuse me. Thank you very much, Rex, for letting me on. However, you can mute my mic, and I will push one when I'm coming in because I'm actually eating dinner. Sorry. I didn't put myself
in
the
Robert.
Queue, so.
You got to be careful about that because I was eat before the show and I, you know, ate a little too much General So's, and General So is winning some battle of the duodenum right now, so I got the freaking hiccups.
I will make noodle soup and some cheese crackers.
you let us know when you're done with your organic local market meal, and in the meantime we'll let Randy riff. So to you, Randy.
That's from a local farmers, I would assume, right?
Of course.
Anyway, go ahead, Randy.
Well, we were just talking about this. At least me and Chris was, and I've had so many conversations here of late. I'm starting to one's kind of running into another. But, you know, one of the points to be made about Afghanistan, here's what's interesting, and we were talking about the NDAA. You know, not everything in the NDAA is evil, but there are certainly chunks of it that are. And, you know, here's one of the interesting things. One of the sections within the NDAA is actually labeled the war on drugs. And so here they've got this this funding for the war on drugs into the military, right? Well, here's an interesting statistic. Okay, Afghanistan, before the American invasion and occupation, Afghanistan was only delivering about somewhere between 7 to 8% of the total amount of heroin coming into these United States of America. Guess what? Since the American occupation, that hasn't gone down because of the war on drugs. Guess what? It's now up to about 85 to 90%. Okay, so tell me what we're doing there in Afghanistan besides maybe harvesting their crops and bringing it into the United States.
Well, and I want to raise a point of clarification for people who talk about the NDAA, okay? There is an NDAA every year, the National Defense Authorization Act, okay? So, you know, for the people listening, you know, a lot of people, particularly in the Liberty Movement or on the Ron Paul side, they tend to talk about the NDAA. There is one every year, so they're speaking about a specific one in a specific year, which, if I'm not mistaken, is the 2011 one where all this stuff came
actually,
up.
Actually, it's the NDAA for 2012 is the one that you're referring
to.
The
2012. Okay. Yep. Yeah. So, you know, it's the 2012 NDAA, just for those who are going to get
and specifically on you, specifically sections 1021 and 1023, where it refers to indefinite detention. Now, the interesting thing is that this particular NDAA also states that these rules will not apply to American citizens on American soil at all, and that's the out that they use to say, see, this is nothing new, except that the wording is so vague that it says something to the effect of affiliation with terrorist organizations, and it specifically lists the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. But,
and
you saw
who Homeland Security released a report as to who they consider a terrorist, right? So,
exactly.
Interesting.
Hey,
and
but
I can tell you, I used to write international agreements for the U.S. government that we would sign. And I always wrote myself a loophole that I could drive a freight truck through if I needed to.
Well, here's the other thing that I wish I could go and put it on my my finger on the archive, because during the Republican presidential debate, I clipped every single thing Romney and, of course, Newt and everybody else said, and we talked about their constitutionally correct, or should I say incorrect, position. And, of course, Romney said that he believed that the president should have sole authority to determine who gets assassinated and who gets hit on these things. And, of course, we're to believe that the president would never abuse that privilege.
Of course not. All men are born of virtue, and they never stray.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Tex. Well, okay, so this is getting back to some parts of his speech, right? Okay, so this is why Romney sucks, okay, right? So I'm just going to start out here. And so this is his prescription for what he's going to do, all right? So in foreign policy, I will evaluate conditions on the ground and weigh the best advice of our military commanders. and I will affirm that my duty is not to my political prospects, but to the security of the nation. You know Frank Luntz focus tested that thing, right? But he is going to, once he becomes president, evaluate the conditions on the ground and weigh the best advice of our military advisors. What, you haven't done this already? You're running for president, for God's sakes. When are you going to get around to doing any of this homework? You know, like, I'm getting a real Barack Obama on the golf course vibe off of you, Mitt. You know, that's putting elevators in your house and all that kind of stuff. I mean, I'm not, you need an elevator, you get an elevator. But I'm just saying, this guy doesn't seem like he's on top of it. And the other thing that bothers me about all this kind of stuff is that, you know, he says all this stuff, and, you know, Chris and Randy, you missed this earlier on in this foreign policy speech, but this to me was a real gem. This is when I knew that they realized that they had a serious problem. Two things tipped me off. He was talking about the movement away from dictatorship and towards democracy, or groping move towards democracy in the Middle East, and he says that, in short, it is a struggle between liberty and tyranny, right? So that's going to be good with the base, because everybody loves Mark Levin's book, Liberty and Tyranny. He even incorporated the title of the book into his speech. That's how cheap it got, you know? And the other thing that gets me worried is how the Democrat media has adopted the meme that Mitt Romney won the debate and Barack Obama did terrible, okay? Because it's got to be a close race. Otherwise, it looks staged and fake. So look for Barack Obama to completely kick ass in either the second or the third debate. It doesn't really matter which one. You know, the problem with him saying things like it is a struggle between liberty and tyranny, and saying all these highly focused group things where he said, this is another part of Frank Luntz. Okay, so I just want to read this whole paragraph here, but the kicker is at the end. So, because you got to have the wind-up first. Let's hear the BS wind-up, and then let's get to the kicker at the end. America's security and the cause of freedom cannot afford four more years like the last 4 years. I am running for president because I believe the leader of the free world has a duty to our citizens and our friends everywhere to use America's great influence wisely, with solemnity, and without false pride, but also firmly and actively. Good Lord. To shape events I'm starting to get turned on. Anyway, to shape events in ways that secure our interests, further our values, prevent conflict, and make the world better, not perfect, but better. Oh, I wish the world could be better. You know, Mitt, let's go make the world better. I don't want the world to be perfect. Perfect, that's asking too much. Let's just go make it better. Let's go spend $1 billion all over the freaking planet to make it better. You know those focus groups. Like, well, would you support a foreign policy to go make the world perfect? Oh, no, I wouldn't support that. You know, I think because you can't make the world perfect. Okay, would you support it if it was going to make the world better? Ah, sure, better be okay. Yeah, I'll support better. Whatever is that called?
Who does he think,
trillion?
Yeah, who does he, think he is?
What
Miss America?
In Korea, are they doing what Romney said? We've got, 30,000? I mean, why don't we have just, like, one guy standing, you know, as a tripwire? It's absurd. It's just ridiculous.
Or one nuclear missile would do the job.
Exactly right.
You know, it's amazing. It sounds like he's running for, you know, like Miss America. You know, he wants world peace and a better world. I think it's fascinating. But the question I have to ask, Tex, in that speech you just read, what did he mean by our interests? Did he mean the United States, the bankers on Wall Street who paid for his campaign, the LDS church? I mean, who does he mean by our? Because it wasn't really clear or specified.
Well, he kind of goes on about the scope. I don't think any of you are going to be surprised at the scope. It is global in nature. He says, so this is when he was talking about evaluating effects in the ground and all that kind of stuff. He was, right after that, he committed, finally, I will recommit America to the goal of a democratic, prosperous Palestinian state living side by side in peace and security with the Jewish state of Israel. And then he goes on to say, okay, never mind how likely that is to ever happen. In this old conflict, as in every challenge we face in the Middle East, only a new president will bring the chance to begin anew. Oh, yeah. Those people in the Middle East, they've seen Barack Obama and his old-timey tricks and all that kind of. They want a new face. Hey, this new guy's going to come with all these brand-new ideas that haven't been tried over here for 40 freaking years. I mean,
well, maybe he was referring to third-party candidates, you know, being the new face.
That's true. Yeah, someone who actually cares about the United States of America. But, you know.
Maybe that's.
I think what he was saying is that we get a new face with the same old crappy policies, so we get a nice rhetorical difference. But in reality, basically, we end up.
Now what the fuck are we supposed to do? We're some real pretty shit now, man.
That's basically the summary of his speech.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, the thing is, it's long on why Obama sucks. It is short on why Romney is better, except that he has a lot of platitudes and banalities. And talking about the expanse of our obligations, he says that there is a longing for American leadership in the Middle East. Are you guys feeling that longing? You feel that? I feel that every day.
No. Yeah.
I wake up and I just feel this deep-set longing, like, Dan, what are you doing for the Middle East? What's going on, Texas? Anyway, and it's not unique to that region. Oh, my gosh, it's all over the place. The world's breaking out with love for the United States. Broadly felt by America's friends and allies in other parts of the world as well. In Europe, where Putin's Russia cast a long shadow over young democracies, and where the oldest allies have been told we are pivoting away from them. In Asia, across the Pacific, where China's recent blah, blah, blah. And here in our own hemisphere, where that douchebag Hugo Chavez and Castro are, you know, I don't know, rubbing their magic rings or whatever they do when they get together. But, I mean, my God, there's 315 million Americans. There's like 7 billion people on a freaking planet, you know. I mean, well, we got to fix all this stuff. But Mitt Romney has an answer. So he says many Americans are asking a different question. Why us? Right? I know many Americans are asking whether our country today, with our ailing economy and our massive debt and all this money that we've printed up and the horseshit candidates that we have saying all this bullshit up. Oh, sorry, I went off script. With our ailing economy and our massive debt and after 11 years of war, is still capable of leading. I believe that if America does not lead, others will, blah, 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 and the world will grow darker for our friends and for us. Yeah, well, the world's not going to grow brighter if you're freaking bankrupt, okay? So some parts of the world, you know what? Leave the hell alone.
Well, let me say, as a Marine who has been around the globe and have been into these countries, they don't want us there leading. They want us to get the Sam Hill out of their country and leave them the frick alone.
That's a novel idea. It's a novel idea that someone doesn't want a foreign power controlling their country. And interestingly enough, though, that attitude that you're expressing that most foreigners who we happen to invade feel is not quite shared here domestically, because it seems that our occupiers are welcome and we give them our vote every 2 and 4 years.
God, you're right.
And don't you find it fascinating that the same tactics and tools that we are using to invade, quote, those guys, the terrorists or whoever else might be trying to kill us, are the same tactics and tools that they are using to provide us with security from ourselves? Doesn't that, I mean, let me throw that to Mike from a psychological perspective. How can we voluntarily choose our own bondage? And what is it that we can, I mean, I know we talked about how futile it is to change someone's paradigm, but the fact is if we don't, then, you know, we're screwed. So what can we possibly do with all the stuff we've been talking about now, which I believe is pretty hardcore truth, what can we do to convince others, irrespective of their left-right paradigm, that, you know, the oligarchy is putting forward the same duopoly choice and they're furthering their agenda of command and control over us? And if you want to be free, whether you're a liberal or a conservative is irrelevant, if you want to be free, why are you voting for your own occupiers?
Right. Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think I truly believe that America is a libertarian society. I think that's the way we were founded. I think that's the way we existed for a long time until, you know, maybe TR and Woodrow Wilson and so forth. But, you know, I think that's our nature. And there are differences between cultures. And we talk about, you know, invading these different countries. And, you know, you try and invade a, you know, collectivist culture, like North Korea or something like that, it's just doomed for failure, because you look at China, like, you know, China is a big competitor of ours. Yes, that's true. but they should throw off the shackles of communism. Well, they don't really want to do that because they feel fairly comfortable with the way things are working right now. So I think it's really, I'm not sure how we do that exactly, but I do think we are a libertarian country. I do think we're one that is based on individual rights. Yeah.
Well, Mike, I'd ask you,
sorry,
do you know the
like
one
really
area where North Korea outperforms
there.
All other nations?
What's that?
Do you know the one area where North Korea outperforms all other nations?
Dying in mass amounts. I don't know. Famine.
Well, okay. So that's the other one. Okay, so that was the other option. But income equality. Yes, they have the world's greatest income equality.
Exactly.
Because no one has anything.
Yep. And you can actually see this by, it's an empirical fact. If you look at a satellite image of Southeast Asia at night, you will see a massive amount of electric light emanating from South Korea, and North Korea is pitch fucking black.
Yep.
And
well,
if that's
the Department
kind of
we
country...
call it the black hole. That's what we called it. It's the black hole. That's what it's called.
Yeah.
I'll just tell you.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you this, though. Isn't North Korea technically more dangerous towards the United States as a committed communist nation with a starving population? And generally speaking, when communist nations have starving populations, they tend to expand through imperial takeover. Doesn't that make them a far more dangerous nation to us, especially since they have about 100 nukes? And if that's the case, why are we not mentioning North Korea, other than the fact that we've got 30,000 troops who can't do anything to stop a nuclear weapon stationed at the 38th parallel, but we are hardcore rattling the sabers to go after Iran, which doesn't even yet have a nuclear weapon, and if they do have one soon, it'll be one, and maybe in the next 2 years, two. So can anyone explain to me why?
Yeah, that's a question that answers itself. The answer is China. Because North Korea, right? North Korea is a piece of crap country with nothing, basically literally nothing. Now, they do have a fanatic army of thousands, and if they ever did come storming across the DMZ, as all our military planners fear, they're going to go down to South Korea, and like you hear about those Japanese guys who are like in those hot dog eating contests, they're going to come down to South Korea and they're going to eat all their hot dogs, right? Because what, are these guys going to fight? You seen these dudes? I mean, they're like toothpicks. What are they going to do, right?
Food.
They're not going to fight for North Korea. That thing would go like a house of cards. But the problem is China doesn't want America right on its border, which is exactly what would happen. So North Korea is this nightmarish. The entire country is the DMZ between South Korea and China. And China could shut North Korea down in 2 seconds if it wanted to, because China exports North Korea food and they send them energy. And the second, and you can see how much energy they're getting, not a lot, it's like a 9-volt battery they send over there every month, it's like for the whole country, here's 9 volts, use it wisely. They could shut the thing down, but they don't want America or the West on its border. That really is what's going on.
And wouldn't you also say that China's the real reason that we're not, that our power is being focused on Iran, given the fact that the Iranians are suffering severe sanctions at the request of the global bankers, primarily because they don't have a central bank that plays ball with the Rothschild interests globally, and the fact that they're what, the second largest OPEC producer, Tex?
They have slipped into third place.
Okay.
Because, that actually happened recently back in May.
They're
third place because their reserve.
Okay.
The thing about a producing oil well is you have peak production, which happens soon after the field comes online, and then it kind of forever goes into a state of decline. Now you can do enhanced oil recovery and have a bump up, but they're declining because we're not exporting, and no oil companies are allowed to go fix their wells, and they seem to be incapable of doing it on their own. So.
And Texas, isn't it true that Iran, although it is the third largest OPEC producer of crude,
that their refining capability is so limited that they actually have to import their finished product for use in their economy.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, well, that's, yeah, but that's just a scam. I mean, the thing is, their elites are screwing their people over as well, right? Because, you know, that's kind of what elites tend to do. So they decided what they would do is they export it either to India or they export it to Singapore. Singapore is a huge refining hub. And the Iranian oil gets refined there and it gets shipped back to Iran. And a lot of people in power there make money off of this.
So they screw their people and they're doing well. And so doesn't it help them to continue to screw their people by... it's like that movie, I don't know if you ever saw it, it's called The Mouse That Roared. This small European kingdom was suffering, and so they decided the only way that they could get their infrastructure built up was to declare war on the United States, because as soon as they declared war on the United States, the troops would come in and they would take over, and then the Americans would rebuild their country. So isn't it possible that the Iranians are welcoming this fight with us because it helps them gin up the fear in their people?
I don't know. Stab me in the lung. Help me out. You know, but I will tell you, in the Civil War, there is an anecdotal story of a Civil War general fighting for the, I think this was at the North or the South, I can't remember. Anyway, Civil War general comes up, you can imagine blue or gray, as your biases may be, and he sees a guy standing behind a tree, and he's got his arms out on both sides of the tree, just waving them around frantically, right? And it's almost like he ran into the tree and he's just grappling at it to get it away or something. So the general looked over at him and said, "What in the hell are you doing?" And he said, "I'm feeling for a furlough, sir." A furlough being time off from the war. So he was hoping to get shot in the finger or something, he could go the hell home. So maybe Iran's feeling for a furlough.
Or something.
Maybe. All right, we're in the last 12 minutes of show, so why don't we do this? Why don't we have Randy and then Chris sound off, and then we'll bring Robert in real quick to promo what he's got going on, and then we'll throw it to Mike, and then Tex and I will close out. So Randy and then Chris.
I'm going to be uncharacteristically short. I just want to tell you guys how much I appreciate what you're doing. I appreciate the fact that you guys, in fact, I just said it earlier, that you know, it's a breath of fresh air to connect with people that get it, and I'm not beating them over the head with a 2x4 to get it. So appreciate that.
Well, we appreciate you
Randy,
being here, Randy. Go ahead, Tex.
I'd just say we're happy to have you here, and, you know, the more that we can meet like-minded people and, you know, link up and start, you know, creating some kind of network that can hopefully change this country for the better, I think the better off we're all going to be.
Indeed. Thanks for having me here.
Thank you, sir, and we'll see you soon. Chris seemed to have fallen off, so I'm going to bring Robert on unless he is still eating his soup. But, Robert, if you're done eating, if you would like to comment and then give us a little idea of what's coming up on Bard's Logic Political Talk, that'd be great.
Yes, the soup and crackers is gone. Thank you very much for having me on. Hey, the poet didn't know it, that rhymed. Anyway, I digress. About China, one thing I'd like to spend a little more time, and of course not now, is you know, the China's relation with Taiwan and with the Taiwan Act, Taiwan Relation Act. I won't mind talking more about that. Not tonight, of course, there's not enough time, but, you know, at some point. But tomorrow there is Kermit Steck from the Constitution Party for the U.S. Senate in Tennessee. And then I also have another person coming on. I'm trying to pull that up real quick. Oh, where's she at? Oh no, I feel so bad. I don't have it up here, but I know I have Kermit Steck from Tennessee on, and then I have a lady coming in, Miss Fick from Pennsylvania, tomorrow night. And if you do, you have a link for tomorrow night's show, Rex? Or
I don't have one handy, but I could probably find one.
For the Rex and Tex show, you guys doing another show tomorrow night?
No. We are not. We're actually. Yeah. Tex and Rex are taking a break tomorrow night. Sammy Sanford at 10 o'clock Eastern is doing Constitutional Conservatives Unite, and he will be interviewing Vice Presidential candidate for the Constitution Party, Jim Clymer. So we're taking the night off. Well, I say taking the night off. I think I'm actually going to be on that show, but we won't be running Tex and Rex tomorrow night. We'll be back Wednesday at 10.
to understand. So these question, schedules right? are throwing me off a little bit, but thank you for having me on.
All right. Well, it's for all intents and purposes, for the most part, other than adjustment for so-called debates, we will be 10 p.m. Eastern every day from now until the election. So thanks, Robert. And everybody, please follow Robert's show on Blog Talk Radio, Bard's Logic Political Talk. And we're down to 10 minutes, and I would kind of like to, unless you got something to say, I'd like to throw it to Mike and kind of get his take on the general conversation we had today and some of the points that he made earlier.
No, that's fine. Go ahead, Mike.
Sure. I think that this was a very interesting discussion from my standpoint, and we brought up a lot of issues, covering the debates and also foreign policy. I tend to gravitate towards the foreign policy debate issue a little bit more, just given my interests, outside of my profession. So, and it was great to have everybody else on the show. So, if anybody has any questions, you can certainly ask me right now. I'll do my best to answer them. But otherwise, I thought it was a really fruitful discussion, and it is it is a very nice thing to hear from like-minded folks. So,
well, that's one thing that Tex and Rex we like to do is kind of get people from divergent backgrounds who have different views but agree on some basic fundamentals about the political direction of our country. And I found your contribution to be invaluable to address some of the things from a psychological perspective. And what I do have a question in the last 10 minutes, something that we can,
sure.
Tex and Rex, we always try to give someone something to take away, some practical action that they can take in order to further the cause of liberty and restore constitutional government. We talked about the ingrained paradigms and the worldviews, and I think we've touched on this several times in the episode, but I'd just like to close out with this. What particular points could you give people, given that people are so ingrained in these paradigms, and some of the people listening, we've shared these ingrained paradigms, but because of the audacious actions of both the RNC and the DNC at their conventions, which were absolutely staged, and it's just very evident that they are, we've sort of woken up. So given that we're awake and that we were ingrained in these same paradigms, how can we reach out to our brothers and sisters who are still stuck in this duopoly paradigm and help them come into the light of freedom?
I would say point out the most extreme discrepancies in their thought patterns. In terms of I'm pro freedom in this area, but I'm very much in favor of the government being in charge of another area. That's the most sort of successful thing that I've found just in my personal life. When I talk to friends or family members or whoever it may be, and we talked about cognitive dissonance before, but if you point those things out, it has to be resolved at some point. So if you say you're pro-abortion, but you're anti-death penalty, or you're pro this, pro against that. I like the fact that Obama killed, Osama bin Laden, but I'm against drone strikes. There are things that are inherently, different. And I think if you point those things out, you're not necessarily going to change somebody's mind, but I think you have a better chance of doing that. So that would be
great. Mike, would you say pointing out these glaring contradictions in their thought patterns is first going to make them uncomfortable? And B, how might they react to you, even if you're close friends? I mean, in other words, if you tell somebody who
might be pro-choice,
get
angry with you. Yeah, exactly. You're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
well, Mike, I can get some firsthand experience. They actually love it, and they invite your criticisms, and they think about it thoughtfully, and they do not at all yell at you or throw things and or maybe get kicked out of the house.
Yeah. It's always pleasant. No, but I mean, I think your example is perfect when you say, I'm pro-choice when it comes to what a woman can do with her baby, but yet I don't think anybody should own a handgun.
Right.
Is that really a pro-choice position? I mean, you know, you're saying
exactly.
that you get to control a product I can own, but you could do whatever you want with the baby inside your body. So I think that, and a lot of people do share those views, which technically, I mean, from a rational perspective, those kinds of thoughts can't occupy the same place at the same time. So I think if you bring it out, and I think, would you say, Mike, that it's best to bring this out by asking the person to make the statements themselves as opposed to telling them? In other words, not saying, because you're pro-abortion, how can you be pro-gun control? Or would you just simply ask them, well, how do you feel about a woman's right to choose, and how do you feel about people being able to choose what kind of weapon they want to own? And then let them
expose
the contradiction.
That's a great point, Rex, and I've always been a fan of the Socratic method for achieving those results, where you just ask questions about it, and you bring that out, and then you make people think about it. It's not going to take a day. It's going to take maybe a couple of months for them to try and reconcile those contradictory thoughts. So, but yeah,
you'll never
convert
anyone that night. That's not going to happen.
I've tried. But...
Well, Mike, thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it. I'm going to throw it to my co-host to wrap up with you, and then in the last 2 minutes, he and I will give our closing statements. But I really appreciate you being here, and I appreciate your insights. I think they've been very helpful.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Mike. And I just want to say, if you ever want to call in anytime, please dial in. You're welcome to be here, and you're definitely contributing a lot to the show. But also want to say about Mitt Romney, and if you're listening and people are excited about his debate performance, and you're excited about his foreign policy speech where he's given some specifics. I didn't necessarily see too many specifics, but if you believe there were specifics, I'm not going to try to change your mind. But just remember, it's an Etch-a-Sketch, and after he gets elected president, he'll do whatever the heck he wants, just like he did when he was governor of Massachusetts when he enacted Romneycare, which is Obamacare. As the guy who worked with Romney to craft Romneycare in Massachusetts, who later left Mitt Romney's group in order to join Obama, to help him craft Obamacare, that guy who wrote the bills said, it's the same fucking bill, direct quote.
Now, Tex, let's be clear about something. You know, this is Tex and Rex, and we're bound to use inflammatory language, and I've told people that there will probably be cussing as a warning to get their women and children out of the room, but that guy didn't actually say, it's the same fucking bill, did he?
He sure as shit did. That's exactly what he said. He said, and this is in an interview with, like, the major media. He's like, it's the same fucking bill. That's what he said. I'm not kidding.
Well, the only response I have to that statement, Tex, is that's a big fucking deal, to quote Vice
that
President
is a big fucking
Joe
deal.
Biden. I'm quoting Vice President Joe Biden, of course, who will be debating Paul Ryan, Mini Mitt, sometime this week. Is it tomorrow or is it Thursday, Tex?
You know, well, I was just going to say, you know, the reason Romney did that, I think it's because he's a major league a-hole, right? And you're supposed to say big time. That was the big change.
Big time. Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
So what was your question again?
I think that Mini Mitt and Gaffa Minute Joe are debating sometime this week. It's either tomorrow or Thursday. I can't recall, but we will
I think they're going at each other's faces with finger paints or something really entertaining. You know,
should be exciting.
So
well,
this will probably be the best debate of the entire election. So if you're interested in these types of things, I would definitely tune into this one because, you know, I don't know, maybe someone's flatulent in the middle of the debate. I mean, you never know with Joe. He's the type of guy who will shoot himself in the foot, look right in the camera, shoot himself in the other foot, and then wrap his feet with bandages and, as Newt Gingrich said, leave a trail of blood in the snow as he putters off the stage. That's how
good
Joe Biden is.
Agreed, but I will say that I think out of the four duopoly debates, I think this debate will actually be the most substantive and exciting. The other two are just pathetic. And, of course, the major debate is coming up on October 23rd in the other candidates. All right, we're down to the last minute and a half, so, Tex, why don't you make your closing statements, and then we'll call it a night.
Well, do I have a closing statement or anything? It's just that, look, you know, I don't like Barack Obama. I can't stand the guy. No, he should never be the president of the United States. He sucks, right? Okay, but we got a problem. The guy you're replacing him with is Mitt Romney, and he basically believes exactly the same freaking things. And
If he gets elected president, he gets elected president as a Republican, and he destroys your brand, just like George Bush Jr. destroyed your brand and Karl Rove destroyed your brand by spending all that money. We're really going to be screwed come November 7th because this guy's going to go in there and he's going to fuck you. That's exactly what's going to happen, and you're not going to have anything to say about it.
Yep, and those of us who will have something to say about it are those that haven't thrown away our vote on an insipid candidate like Mitt Romney. Again, I want to thank Mike for being here and giving us some insights. Of course, Randy, Chris, Robert, and, of course, Sammy Sanford for calling in, and my co-host, Tex. We will be taking a break tomorrow night, so join us on Constitutional Conservatives Unite to interview Jim Clymer with Sammy Sanford at 10 p.m. We will be back Wednesday and every night from now till the election at 10 p.m., so please follow the show, Tex and Rex, on Blog Talk Radio. Download the
you fell off, dude. Are you there? Hello?